throughout the Persian period, certain changes were taking place that while Judea was able to enjoy its own unique way of life with its own not only language and cultural traditions, but most important to most of the people who were there, their own religious traditions, that they were allowed to enjoy their own form of worship and to enjoy the privilege of being able to be ruled and administered according to their religiously derived body of law as far as internal government was concerned. One major transition had already occurred during that Persian period, and that was a change in relationship between the civil and religious administration. Of course, during the period of the monarchy prior to the exile, the king, of course, was in charge of the civil administration, and he was the top dog, so to speak, in the social and political and pyramid in every way. And the high priest was simply a functionary, a very important functionary, but of considerably less status and influence than that of the king. When the return was initiated, the first governors were members of the royal house. And therefore, although they didn't carry the title of king, and they are working hand in hand with the high priest, they are head of the civil administration, somebody of the household, rather the house of David. Although instead of having a situation where you've got the king up here and the high priest over here, you've got a situation where they're more on equal status. But there is an equality of status between the royal, the governor who has royal blood, and the high priest. Beginning with the emperor Darius, because of the civil wars that had preceded his gaining control of the empire, much of it stimulated by governors of provinces who were of royal blood, who saw an opportunity to become independent, since they were the traditional ruling families of their provinces, he got rid of all these royal governors. And succeeding royal governors tended to be of rather middling status and reputation. Except, of course, for, in the case of Nehemiah, you have somebody of quite importance, great importance from the Persian administration who was appointed as governor of Judea. And so the governors begin to diminish in the minds of the people. In the minds of the people, the status of the governor is steadily being diminished, leaving the high priest as a significant figure in Judea. He is beginning to emerge as more important in the minds of most people than the governor, who is, if he's a Jew at all, is somebody of really no great consequence other than in terms of family background, and in some cases was not even a Jew, but was a Persian official appointed, of some other people. Though he showed due respect to the Jewish way of things, he was sometimes not even a Jew. And the textbook mentions that at least in one instance there was even a bit of conflict between a non-Jewish Persian governor of Judea and the high priest. Then we come in time, is that on? I don't think so. To the third of the prophetic kingdoms, which is to rule in the Near East, symbolized among the beasts as the leopard with the four heads. And of course, this was fulfilled in the beginning by Alexander, whom the leopard represents, who accomplished one of the most rapid conquests ever known in the history of the world. Alexander conquered more territory in a shorter amount of time than has ever been done by any other single individual. And so quite appropriately, the leopard is used to describe him. Now, when the beast is described as having four wings and four heads, we have to understand that this is not the immediate result of what happened when Alexander died. It's the same thing in the next chapter, chapter 8, where we're introduced to the ram with two horns and the he-goat that had a large, very notable horn in his forehead. That after the he-goat had prospered, expanding his dominion in all directions, that great horn was broken. And it says, in its place came up four horns. We have to understand that was not the immediate result. Alexander the Great died in 323 BC, But this condition of the four horns, the four divisions of his empire, you probably couldn't speak of that as being in existence until about 301 B.C. So it took almost a little over 20 years for the surviving generals of Alexander to sort of eliminate their rivals and consolidate power into these four major divisions. And so therefore the prophetic symbol in chapter 7 that we see on the screen here, and the one I've been alluding to in chapter 8, where the he-goat had its horn broken and four different horns came up in its place, was fulfilled by approximately 301 B.C. Now, I do need this for another slide in a minute. Now, of the four divisions, from the point of view of Middle East in politics and certainly Judea is concerned, only two of the divisions proved to be important. And they are developed, of course, later in the book of Daniel, especially in chapter 11, and they are identified as the king of the north and the king of the south. The king of the north refers to the king of the Seleucid Empire, or some like to say Seleucid, which possessed a good part of Asia Minor, the area of Mesopotamia, and the area even to the borders of India at one time. This is a very diverse, very large, very extensive empire. The other one, the king of the south, that was to prove influential in the affairs of Judea, was the Ptolemaic kingdom, which involved not only Egypt and Libya, at least the coastal areas of it, but some of the important islands of the eastern Mediterranean in the Aegean Sea, especially Rhodes and Cyprus, and the southern borders of Asia Minor, and, of course, the Lebanese coast, Judea, the area of present-day Jordan, and this part of the Sinai. This was part of the Ptolemaic kingdom in approximately, as you can see on here, 270 B.C. Now, the names Seleucid or Seleucid and Ptolemaic kingdom come from the names of Alexander's generals that were the first rulers of these two kingdoms. Alexander had a general by the name of Seleucus, and he had a general by the name of Ptolemy. And so this is where the names of these two particular kingdoms came from. As you can see, that following the death of Alexander, and once the dust had cleared and we emerged with the four divisions of Alexander's empire, Judea was initially part of the Ptolemaic kingdom rather than the Seleucid kingdom. And so the topic for today is to take a look at the conditions of Judea under Ptolemaic rule. Now, before we get into the specifics of that, we should get an impression as to which of these two kingdoms, the kingdom of the north or the kingdom of the south, was the stronger. Which of the two was the stronger? And I might say that if you subtract the empty ocean from the territory of the Ptolemaic kingdom, you would realize that the extent of the Ptolemaic kingdom is maybe a third or a quarter of the extent of the Seleucid kingdom. However, that's rather misleading. The Ptolemaic kingdom was far stronger initially than the Seleucid kingdom. Now, the reason for that is that the Seleucid kingdom embraced many, many diverse peoples of different religions, different languages, different cultural and legal traditions. It was very hard to impose and maintain a unity over such a diverse and extensive area. However, in the case of the Ptolemaic kingdom, the bulk of the population in the kingdom and the bulk of the wealth and the power of the kingdom was in Egypt. If you have, you probably had at least 85 or maybe even 90% of the population in the whole kingdom was Egyptian, and at least 90% of the wealth was Egyptian. And so therefore, most of the Ptolemaic kingdom was, practically speaking, Egypt, which was a homogeneous unit. ethnically, by traditions, both cultural and legal. It was a homogeneous unit. And so therefore, this was a great source of strength to the Ptolemaic kingdom. There was also another very great source of strength that helped this new Macedonian ruler establish himself effectively as the undisputed and absolute, you might say, ruler of Egypt. And that is, he did not rule Egypt as a Macedonian conqueror king. He ruled Egypt as Pharaoh. That was his title. Even though he didn't have a drop of Egyptian blood, he still ruled Egypt as Pharaoh and wore the traditional symbols that Egyptian pharaohs for thousands of years had worn, the double crown. And, of course, by this virtue of this, how was he regarded by his subjects in Egypt? Mr. Holder. All right. You see, he was able to cash in, if you will, on the traditional awe and reverence that the Egyptian people had given to their pharaohs. He was able to inherit that kind of response from, therefore, the bulk of his population of his kingdom. And so not only did he have the advantage of having a very homogeneous unit as the bulk of his kingdom, but he was the undisputed and easily accepted, willingly accepted, absolute ruler of that kingdom by the bulk of his people. Now, another advantage that he had is he had an extensive and highly efficient bureaucracy. An extensive and highly efficient bureaucracy. A bureaucracy made up of royal scribes, who you can look upon as record keepers, from the village level all the way up to the royal court. A well-oiled, efficiently functioning bureaucracy with a chain of command and communication flowing both ways through the chain of command from the very top at the royal court down to the smallest village. So as a result of this very extensive and efficient bureaucracy, there was a very accurate record-keeping system. Especially what kind of records do government leaders like to have in good order? Yes. Because governments run on money. And so therefore, they had very accurate tax records, and therefore they had a very easy job in Egypt to have efficient collection of the full taxes that were owed to the government, because you have this very extensive and already very efficiently functioning bureaucracy. In other words, what you have to see too, well, I'll mention one other point and then I'll mention this one. In addition, in Egypt, he inherited the existing feudal system of land tenure. Now, I'm using this term, a feudal system, and I suggest we put it in quotes, because the term itself really describes varying conditions that existed in Europe between, let us say, the 10th century and, let's say, the 15th century. And, of course, that varied tremendously in what part of Europe you're talking about and from century to century. But essentially, we had a similar system, and it's not unfair to borrow the term. Because what is the essence of the feudal system? What was the essence of the feudal system? We have reduced it to its barest minimum. Alan?
Is that where the king or the ruler of the area would promise to work or service to take care of?
Right. That an official that performs specific services for the king on his behalf is paid by a grant of land, and he enjoys the income from that land. Now, that's why I think we can fairly use this system, this term, even though, of course, we're wrenching it out of its proper historical context. Because all high officials, all high military and civil officials, were paid through grants of estates, in other words, lands. And of course, whatever income those lands produced, that was their salary. Now, just as in a well-functioning feudal system, these estates were not the property of the individual, absolutely. He held those estates because he held a certain position. If he changed his position, he would probably be given different estates, because the estates went with the job. He would leave the estates he had previously had to whoever replaced him and take the estates of the person he was replacing. The estates and the job were linked together. So also, if he lost his job, he lost his estates and therefore his income. And also it meant, at least in Egypt, but this was not true in Europe. In Egypt, it was not always a matter of form that one of a man's sons inherited his estates. He would have to inherit his father's job if he wanted to inherit his father's estates. And that didn't always happen in Egypt. You see. So this is another distinction. In Europe, it was more traditional that people normally inherited their father's estates and responsibilities. It was sort of an accepted thing. He had almost a right to do that. You see. And in Egypt, there was no such right, and it was not always followed. Now, this very smoothly functioning system, a means of maintaining the standard of living and the loyalty of top military and civil officials, a well-oiled and functioning tax system with accurate records so the government knew they were being paid the accurate taxes, this was all in place and functioning. The only change that took place essentially in Egypt is before its conquest by Alexander, you had the whole pyramid with an Egyptian pharaoh. And maybe some top officials. Maybe the commander-in-chief of the army and the chancellor of the civil administration and maybe one or two other officials. Then after Alexander's conquest, everything just stayed the same except you had Alexander and some close associates at the top. That was the only change. The rest of the military and civil bureaucracy and the scribes and their record-keeping functions all stayed exactly the same. And of course, after the death of Alexander, the only change that took place then was Ptolemy was in charge instead of Alexander and some of his close associates. So it was very easy to control Egypt because it had a functioning system that he could just slip right into and just keep going. Now, because Egypt, therefore, had this natural unity, it was a sort of a homogeneous unit, and because it had such a smoothly functioning system where it just had the top-level leadership replacing the existing one, there was no need to bring unity to this area. It already had it. And it already had this tremendous loyalty to the ruler. And consequently, in Egypt, although some blending of the native and new population took place, and there was a blending of cultures to a certain degree, it was minimal in Egypt. Because there was no need to bring about this blend of people and cultures to create unity. In the Seleucid Empire, because of its great diversity of peoples, languages, and cultural traditions, the only way the ruler could bring about unity was to encourage as many of the upper class native population to adopt a common culture, the Greek culture, Greek language, Greek religion, Greek legal traditions, Greek forms of political organization, Greek educational system, Greek forms of architecture and dress, This was the only cement that was available to bring into a unity this diverse area. And the way they went about it, and by encouraging these people to do this, was the planting and establishment, which was even begun by Alexander before his death, of Greek colonies throughout the area. The founding of independent, self-governing Greek cities. Small kernel of Greeks, as it was described in your handout. A small kernel of Greeks would be set down in a city that might be an existing city or a new one with a large native population. And the idea was that the large native population, at least the significant members of it, the upper and upper middle class people, would accommodate themselves to the ways of the Greeks, becoming Greeks by cultural adoption. Taking Greek names, learning the Greek language, as I said, worshiping the Greek gods, observing Greek festivals, teaching their children Greek literary classics, and getting involved in Greek athletic competitions, so that the enlarged population would be essentially Greek. Now, it's an interesting thing that what took place was not a pure Greek culture, because there were too many foreigners being brought into the Greek cultural way for it to be a totally Greek culture as it had existed in Greece. What you ended up with was a fusion, as I used in that handout, of Greek and Oriental culture. There was approximately 90% Greek and 10% Oriental. And I had something pointed out to me that I had been unaware of. I've been teaching this material for I don't know how many years, and mentioning this fusion or blend of Oriental and Greek culture that took place in about a 90-10% balance. But I was talking to my Western Civ class about this, and I said, you know, it's interesting that we have the four prophetic empires from the time of Daniel to the end of the age. And when you look at the image, you have gold as the first one. That's a pure metal. Then the second is silver. That's pure. But the third is bronze. Now, our English Bibles say brass, but that's a mistranslation. It should be bronze. Bronze is a fusion or alloy of metals, just as this Hellenistic kingdom were. And what I didn't know until somebody brought it up in that Western Civ class is bronze is made up of 90% copper and 10% tin, which I had never known before, which I think is rather interesting, because this is the approximate balance between the Oriental components and the Greek components in the culture. So I think it's just one of those little interesting little tidbits. So as I said, this did take place in the Ptolemaic kingdom to some degree. And some of the upper-class Egyptians got in on this and adopted the Greek ways and then began to be treated like Greeks because they were given, as it says in the handout, full political and economic and legal equality. And so they could be rise in the system depending on their ability and become high officials and be treated just like the Greeks or Macedonians. But it was more extensively pursued here because there was a greater need. Here there was a self-assured unity. It wasn't as essential to impose cultural conformity. The Seleucid Empire had a great need to impose cultural conformity. We need to keep this as background information for understanding the background, in part, for the persecution we associate with Antiochus Epiphanes, to see the needs of the Seleucid Empire as being very different from the needs of the Ptolemaic Empire. Now, as we see on this map, although the heart of the Ptolemaic kingdom was certainly Egypt, they did have other areas that they governed. Now, I don't want to deal with these areas up here because they're sort of peripheral to our concern. What is important is how these areas were governed, especially Judea. How did the Ptolemaic rulers of Egypt administer these areas? How did they try to incorporate them into the system and try to create unity in that area and loyalty to the Ptolemaic ruler of Egypt? This is what we want to examine. So let us consider this area, which involved Lebanon, well, using modern-day boundaries, Lebanon, southern Syria, Jordan, and Israel. How did they attempt to bring political loyalty and unity to this particular region? So I'm just going to call this region southern Syria because it's more convenient to use one label than, you know, all these other modern-day political boundaries. We could turn that projector off now. I'm going to take this under two headings. Southern Syria excluding Judea. You'll understand why I'm excluding Judea from this area and the procedures that were used by the Ptolemies in a short while. This involves people that were Arameans, Phoenicians, Ammonites, Moabites, Edomites, and, well, I guess you can still have them there, at least ethnically, Philistines also. So you have a number of peoples, you know, that are very diverse from each other. Now, what they did is they took a look at the situation and they said, how can we ensure that this area can militarily be held secure for the empire, for the Ptolemies? Because remember, there's a border with the Seleucid Empire. And after each of them had gotten full, reasonable control of their own empires, there began to be conflict along their common border. Ptolemaic kingdom wanted to hold on to this area, and the Seleucid Empire was desirous of acquiring it. Now, why were they so interested in each of them having this area? I think most of you know. Joey? Yeah, this is the nexus of the trade routes, you see. So it is a very vital strategic area to control. So obviously the Ptolemaic kingdom is very interested in maintaining their effective military control over southern Syria and having it a loyal area. So one of the techniques that was used was the establishment of clerarchies. Now this is a technical term. The singular would be with a Y. And there really is no way I can translate it in one single word. So that's why I'm using the Greek term. Now, what was a clerarchy? It was a settlement of soldiers. A city, you could say. I mean, by a settlement would be a city. But these soldiers were not like a normal garrison. Because normally, if you've got a garrison, they are under military discipline. They're full-time members of the military. They basically just stay in their fort and maybe do some maneuvers and training. But that's it. That's not the purpose that they wanted these people to serve. These could be looked upon as sort of ready or active reserve. In other words, the king, the Ptolemaic king, expropriated land from the local inhabitants. and gave it to these soldiers so that they would have land to farm. And some of them, of course, could go into business-type enterprises if they so desired. And that was their main thing. They settled down with their wives, their children, and their land that they farmed or their business activities. But they were required on a regular basis to assemble for drill and maneuvers and to keep themselves in good physical condition so that if the need arose to act militarily to defend the area, they would have the skills and the expertise, you know, to do it. So you can look at them as sort of an active or ready reserve. Now, can you see some of the beauty in this arrangement? What advantages accrue to the Ptolemaic ruler by using this kind of a system? Maybe here we have the beginnings of the principle of eminent domain. But in this case, there wasn't any compensation. It was just taken away from the local people. So that's one big advantage. What other advantages can you see in this arrangement? Eric? Yeah, because this is more of a normal lifestyle than a visible fort with foreign soldiers, you know, behind the gates kind of thing. Sure, there might have been some resentment at the initial expropriation, but that was sort of the way things were done. So it was sort of, we would get irritated more than these people would have gotten irritated. That was just the fortunes of war, what you expected. You know, you just took it philosophically kind of thing. And of course, even those minor irritations would disappear once you have a normal functioning city here. Well, remember, the locals are allowed, if they wish, to become members of this city as long as they become Greeks by culture. You see, they're allowed to become on an equal basis with these foreign settlers. What other advantages served here? Tom?
Also, the soldiers who want to fight, they want to fight more because they're protecting their own homes and families as well instead of being sent to a foreign.
Yeah. That's another very critical thing. Because remember, this border region was considered vital to the Ptolemies. They wanted to hold this area, you see, against expected Seleucid pressure. These people would have a strong motivation to fight because they're protecting everything that they own and everything that they love. They're not just paid soldiers to defend a piece of territory that means nothing to them. So all these advantages, you see, were accrued by using this particular technique. So we have settlement of soldiers as sort of an active reserve on expropriated land. And I hope you will write down the advantages, since I'm not going to take the time to do so, but they are important that this serve. Second, we have the opportunity for the native population to acquire social, legal, political equality with this soldier citizenry. Because you have the setting up of a Hellenistic city, and as long as they adopt the Greek culture, they can be full participants. And so, as I say, it takes away a lot of the resentment. Now, obviously, this would really affect the upper class and the upper middle class. The peasant population is just having enough of a struggle to make ends meet to worry about what culture they follow and so on. But those are the people that are really important anyway. The leadership group, the upper classes and upper middle classes, those are the ones you want on your side. Now, third item, tax collection, always important. The problem was there was no efficient and well-established bureaucracy in these areas. Therefore, there was no way, without a great deal of effort and expense, the Ptolemaic rulers could set up an efficient tax record system to ensure that they were getting the proper tax returns. They just weren't available. So they introduced a new system, which was called tax farming. Now, you may
wonder, what in the world is tax farming? How do you farm taxes? Not how do you farm corn or wheat, but how do you farm taxes?
Well, the principle of farming, if you want to get down to real basics, is you put seed in the ground, a certain amount of seed, but you, given proper soil and water and other conditions, when you harvest, you get back more than you put into the ground. I mean, that's the principle behind farming. It's the same thing here. Is what it was, is they would say to individuals or groups of individuals living in the area, the right to collect the taxes for this region is up for bid. If you win the bid, you can go around and collect the taxes and keep whatever you collect. Now, why would that be a very efficient way to maximize returns to the government? Can you see the logic behind that? Yes. Well, you probably don't quite understand the system. The taxes collected by the person, he keeps all of it. All he has to do is bid a certain amount of money, and if the government accepts his bid, he pays that money to the government, and then that gives him the freedom to go and collect the taxes and keep whatever he collects. You see. The government is paid by the winning bidder paying them directly, a lump sum of money. And then whatever he collects from the people, that's his to keep. Now, why is this very clever? And would certainly guarantee the government got a good return on their money. Johan? Yeah, so now the burden is on these private entrepreneurs to figure out what is the expected tax yield of this area. Okay, I want X amount as a profit, therefore I reduce that by that amount, and that's my bid. But everybody's going to try to figure it pretty closely because they know other people are bidding, and if their bid is too low, they won't get it, you see. And if their bid is too high, they won't get enough in income to offset what they paid the government. So they're going to be very careful to assess this as well as they can. So it puts the burden of trying to figure out what is the effective tax yield on private entrepreneurs rather than having the burden and expense of that on the government, you see. It sort of guarantees, because of human nature, that this is going to come out to the government's advantage and they're going to get a very accurate sum of money based on the yield. Because remember, these tax farmers don't want to bleed the people till there's nothing there. Because if they do that, there will be nothing to be yielded the next year. You know, they don't want to kill the goose that's going to lay the golden egg year after year after year. So you want to get a lot out of them, but not enough to prevent the people from being productive, you see. So, therefore, this was a very efficient method, you see. But it was adopted because there was no functioning extensive system of tax records and bureaucracy the way there was in Egypt. Now, Judea was handled differently, though. This is the situation outside of Judea. Why was Judea handled differently? Well, you see, it's interesting. It's the way the Ptolemaic rulers approached Judea, the way they analyzed its situation. In Egypt, Pharaoh owned all the land of Egypt. And it was his to give out as estates, you know, to various high-ranking officials. But there was one notable exception. What kind of land, for thousands of years, had remained independent of Pharaoh's control?
The land controlled by the priests.
Yeah. In other words, temple-owned land, controlled and administered by the priests of the different Egyptian gods, had remained out of Pharaoh's control since the days of Joseph, you see. That was the only land, if you go back and look in Genesis, You know, when the people had nothing to eat, they sold their land to Pharaoh or gave it to him in exchange for the food from the granaries. That's where you can trace this claim of land ownership in part of Pharaoh's too. But it says, except the temples, the priests of the temples, they did not sell their land to Pharaoh. It always, from that time on, remained outside the control of Pharaoh. And so temple-owned land administered by a priest was always considered to be not up for control by the civil rulers. Now, when they approached Judea, who was the ruler, effectively, of Judea in this period of time? Well, when the Persian administration collapsed, of course, the Persian governor was not functioning. The only one who was there to be functioning as some sort of a leader, community leader, was the high priest. And in fact, it was the high priest who had gone out to meet Alexander to beg that he would spare Jerusalem. And apparently, according to Josephus, God had given Alexander a dream the night before that a certain man of a certain appearance wearing certain kind of vestments was going to come to see him and that he should treat him kindly if he wanted further successes. And then lo and behold, in the morning, this individual appears, who's the high priest, who looks exactly like the man in his dream. And Alexander was very favorable to the Jews as a result. So from the days of Alexander, the one who was recognized by the Greek rulers in the area as sort of even the civil head of the community was the high priest. So when the Ptolemies looked at Judea, they said, well, this situation is sort of like temple land on a grander scale, yes, but it seems like this whole area of Judea is run and ruled by this high priest of the God of Jerusalem. If we're to fit it into the way we classify things in Egypt, it's temple land. And so none of these procedures were applied to Judea. You can see how this would have interfered with the way of life in Judea considerably if it had been introduced. But because Judea had this, was given this classification of temple land, it was treated like temple land in Egypt, which was considered to be subject to the king's authority, but not, you know, to be incorporated into the administrative system in the same way as other property. So the priest, the high priest in Jerusalem, was viewed as the community representative and civil administrator of Judea, responsible to the Ptolemaic king, you know, for the loyalty and proper functioning of the area. And he was responsible for paying an annual tribute payment in lieu of, you know, taxes. He was responsible for securing it in whatever way he wanted to and paying it to the Ptolemaic king, just as recognition of the Ptolemaic king as the overlord of the area. But in every other respect, life in Judea went on without any major interference in the unique cultural and religious ways of the Jews. They were the only people not exposed to a heavy Hellenizing influence. They were the only people that were not encouraged strongly to become Hellenized as a way of cementing this region together. They were the only ones who were not subjected to a tax farming system. Now, this is the system as it functioned under the Ptolemies. But they did not remain perpetually under Ptolemaic rule. Around the year, 200 BC, more precisely 198, Judea passed from Ptolemaic rule into Seleucid rule. So next time, what we will take up is the transition from one rule to the other, and what the Jewish leaders did or tried to do to maintain their autonomy, to maintain their unique way of life under their new ruler, and prevent themselves from being subjected to these foreign influences. So we'll take a look at that next time.